Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Casterbridge podcast with a K. I am, as ever, your editor and co-host, Christian Corley, and with me is James McLean. James, are you there?
I'm a little unnerved.
Really? Why? How so?
Because before we started recording this, after speaking to you for about 5 minutes, you asked, am I okay, as in health?
Yeah.
Now, being a podcast heavily based around temporal mechanics and timey-wimey stuff, I have to ask, do you know something that I do not know now but will know later on when you know what I don't know now?
As it happens, and it's funny you should ask.
No, don't want to know.
Dear listener, I'll tell the listener, dear listener, I have no idea. I've just been polite.
How the hell have you actually got a relationship? How did anyone manage to get with you when you can't get things in the right order? You don't speak for 5 minutes and then ask, are you all right?
Well, that's weird. I couldn't recall whether I'd asked you already. I thought, well, hell,
I see now.
Ask him, because if I haven't asked him, I'll sound rude. So what happens, dear listener, is that we have a chat about the podcast beforehand, and I forgot whether or not I'd asked James.
I see. I mean, I think it was quite important we put that at the head of our itinerary for this week.
Yes.
Ahead of all those very dull things like prequels and Stephen Moffat and all those things that no one really wants to know about.
No one gives a damn about those. They want to know how we are.
No one gives a moff about them. Trying that out, seeing if we
couldn't
can get
a
catch on. Couldn't give a grand moff about that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I wouldn't like to speculate as to how Caro Skinner feels about Stephen Moffat at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But Stephen Moffat has apparently told Entertainment Weekly, the latest issue of which in the United States has Doctor Who on the cover, which is for the second time in the last year, which is quite remarkable. If only that happened in 1996. Maybe it did. Distant bell ringing there. However, the basic gist of this is that, speaking to Entertainment Weekly, Stephen Moffat kind of echoed Matt Smith, basically. Matt said on Jonathan Ross show a couple of weeks ago that he takes each show at a time. Stephen Moffat said to Entertainment Weekly about his ongoing position as executive producer and, quote, showrunner, unquote, I just take it a year at a time. Sorry, I was fighting the urge to do a Scots accent then. I just take it a year at a time. I think
glad you won.
I am as well. I think the feeling of it being done for you is quite unambiguous when it suddenly arrives. We never really heard Stephen Moffat speak like that. He said that statistically he is nearer the end than the beginning. He might just be being philosophical about that. Or he might have actual plans to move on. There's a thing in this whole sort of like creative industry where lots of people kind of tend to urge towards boredom, don't they, as things progress, and there's this urge for them to move on. I think possibly this is the same thing with Matt, probably the same thing with David Tennant when it came to Russell T Davies leaving. He thought maybe that was a good time for him to leave as well, as it seems. What do you think? Do you think he's on his way out?
I think he probably is. I think he sort of spelled it out pretty quickly there, pretty succinctly, not quickly.
Yeah.
When he more so on the line when he said that he's nearer the end than the beginning of his tenure. I mean, that to me screams. He did say that, didn't he? In that quote, as I recall,
he so, did say tenure. Indeed,
yes.
I find it a bit of a.
Sorry, yes, but I meant so far as the two statements he made. I think the year at a time is less indicative of his mindset than the first statement, which seemed to be a far more definitive point that he feels that he's not an ongoing producer at this point. Because, I mean, for the last interviews I've seen over the past year, he's constantly said, I'm not leaving Doctor Who and nor is Matt Smith. And now suddenly he's sort of saying there is actually an end to my beginning.
I think
there's a quite strong possibility that 2014 might see differences on both fronts.
Okay.
It sounds And I understand it. I think it's worth pointing out, because I know a lot of people get annoyed about this, because, I mean, people will say, I want someone on as long as Tom Baker or at least as long as John Pertwee. But in the end, there is a momentum to the industry, which is to perhaps answer your question. There is a momentum to the industry which does actually abhor people staying in a role for too long, because it does damage them. I was reading an interview in The Guardian with Kelsey Grammer, who played Frasier from Cheers and Frasier for 20 odd years, and he is still fighting that typecasting. He's had lots of different roles, but none of them have sort of managed to get him away from that image of that one character. So I think, especially with Doctor Who being so iconic and significant for both creators and actors, more so for actors, I can sort of understand why they sit on this feeling. But even now, 20 years since Peter Davison said that, you know, Troughton had said don't star on for any longer than 3 to 4 years, it seems to be a general distance that they want to carry. Yes. And I think also, to answer your point, I'll finish off in saying that's probably fair enough, because once you've done about 3 to 4 years of this character, how much more is there going to be to explore as an actor, and how much is there more to explore as a writer before you start retreading? So, yeah, I think it'd probably be a good time for them to bow out. Not because in any way I think they're bad. I've not agreed with some of the stuff they've done, but I think it is a good era to go for. 3 to 4 years, move on. So you keep yourself fresh as much as the show.
Well, what about the argument that multiple producers in along the line of a Time Lord do that anyway? They refresh it. Take the Tom Baker. It wasn't like Tom Baker with Philip Hinchcliffe for 7 years, true, was it?
It would have been nice. I do agree with you. If Matt had wanted to stay on, I think it would have been very interesting to have seen how another producer would have written for. The producer might not be. Would have framed him in the stories. I think that would have been very interesting indeed. And you're quite right. It's a shame that we've not, in a sense, had that yet. But then, funnily enough, we've only had two producers so far, really. So we've not really had that opportunity. But it would have been kind of nice to have seen either the producer stay on and the actor go, or the actor go and the producer stay on, just see how that. Well, we have seen that with Russell.
Rusty Davies, yeah, with Eccleston and Tennant.
And see how that affects their writing. Because in a sense, maybe you're right. Maybe we're being too nice to them. Maybe in a sense, it's a bad move if both go at the same time. It would be a more interesting move, and more interesting for the one who stays on creatively to see how they cope with a different partnership. It's an interesting point.
It is, right. Okay, we don't know what's happening next year. There's these rumours that Matt Smith is leaving in the Christmas special that have been reported on by both Mirror and The Sun. I should add that these rumours have been around a hell of a long time. So they've only just come to the public domain via these tabloids. Whether or not there's any truth in them, I don't know, but as I say, the rumours have been there for a long time. The interesting thing is, if they're currently producing the Christmas special, and it kind of seems as though they are entering production earlier than they've stated publicly, and they're doing a Christmas special, so anniversary special, Christmas special, Matt Smith leaves, Stephen Moffat's already said the work has started on Series 8, or Series 2014. That says to me that his successor, if Stephen Moffat is leaving, that says to me that his successor is already in place.
There has been speculation on that, though, as well, hasn't there?
There's been a lot of speculation,
been a lot of speculation, but I remember one name coming up recently.
Was he a Northern lad?
I don't know. I don't actually go through the the sock drawers of the potential producers. I don't know what he is, but I know.
Are we talking about Matt Gaetis?
No, I'm not.
We're not, right? Okay. No. Who are you talking about?
I'm wondering if you can guess, because I've forgotten his name.
Toby Whithouse.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yes, there is that possibility. Yeah. He's ready made because he's already run his own show. It's interesting.
I'd be surprised if Gaetis did. I think Gaetis, having such connections to Moffat, I'm not quite sure whether he would. I don't know. He seems quite a creative man. I'm as much as he loves Doctor Who, I don't know. I could see him not doing it. I could see him feeling that it was something that he's been close enough to already and moving.
Well, I know a chap who's. I know that there's. Matthew Graham's name has been bandied around with Doctor Who a lot.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That wouldn't be a surprise to me.
No, and I think that would be quite interesting. I mean, I know people have had sort of dubiousnesses over of the output, but I mean, he's got a lot of experience, a lot of good experience.
Yeah, a lot of experience, yeah.
And I think that's really what you're looking for. I think, as I've said many times before, perhaps the problem with Moffat was the fact that he strikes me as being a far more of a writer than a producer, while Russell T. Davis seems to be, I don't know, I'd probably be doing him an insult saying he's more of a producer than a writer, but he certainly has a longer history in production, which I think you probably need for such a big show. I think it certainly helps.
Yes.
So, someone with a bit more background in the actual mechanics of putting these things through might be better. It might be kind of good, actually, to have someone who comes in who isn't actually a main writer, and it actually goes back to a little more of the old days. And, you know, the head of the show isn't so much necessarily about the writing, and it's about overseeing and actually having...
What about the direction?
So they're not being... Because I know it's a very popular thing, and I know it's a very English thing to do it this way.
Yeah. Well, this is what we touched on last time, isn't it?
Yes.
This whole Doctor Who's unique in the UK. I suppose in some ways, perhaps some of the soaps are going in that direction, but by and large, Doctor Who is the only show where we get obsessed by the executive producer.
Yes. But then, you do still get... I mean, if you look at... I'm thinking things like Life on Mars and Ashes. There was a very strong component in the production to creation. I got the impression anyway from listening to the commentaries. I could be wrong, but I think it may be a separation of that might be better, might help, because I do kind of feel, as I've said with Moffat, I feel he works better when he is a writer, and I kind of feel you can't be doing your best writing and doing your best producing. And I would say the same for Russell T. Davis. I do sometimes wonder if, you know, sometimes there was stuff that he would have done better if he was one or the other. Yeah. And I'm sure there's a lot of people there who would agree with that. But
okay. Yeah. Right. Well, that's the bad news out of the way. The good news is that Doctor Who's back next week in an episode called The Bells of St. John. Matt Smith is back as a Doctor. Jenna Lewis-Coleman is back as another Clara.
So not back at all in some respects. I suppose she is back, yes, but her character is not back necessarily. We don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think we do.
Well, those of us who don't sort of...
A character called Clara is back.
Yes.
Is in it. Yes, yes. Yes. It's not the same. I think we've already established...
It's amazing how many people seem to think it is and are saying, well, I'm looking forward to finding out how she managed to survive those two deaths. And I'm sort of thinking, oh, I'm getting the impression it is actually... literally the same person sort of doing a River Song or a Doctor. And
going on there. Yes.
Interesting. Indeed. Yeah, sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. So that's next week. There's we don't know an awful lot about it. Wi-Fi monsters. I like the idea of that. I don't know about you. Monsters in the Wi-Fi.
It's contemporary, isn't it?
It is contemporary.
Doctor Who does do it, to a certain degree, does its best when it's contemporary. I suppose when it's overtly contemporary, it can sometimes be a bit clunky. I mean, the difference being, say, 10th Planet dealing with Cybermen, dealing with the fear of, you know, of organ transplants and the changes in the medical, and not being such an obvious one compared to, say, Rise of the Cybermen, where you've got the phone stuff. So I think I prefer it when it's a little more subtle, personally, but I'm not here to judge. I'm here just to watch and then judge afterwards.
Well, this is a podcast, so you are here to judge.
Yeah, I'll judge afterwards.
But okay.
I'll try not to judge before.
No, absolutely. Yes, don't prejudge. That's just like reading a book by its cover. That's as everyone knows, that's not wise.
But kind of good, though, because since we've both seen the prequel, we can judge that.
Yes, it's a pleasant little moment. This is the misnomered prequel. These aren't prequels because they're not prequels because we haven't seen the actual episode yet. If we'd seen the episode and then this short film had been that's the episode, then it would be a prequel. But as it is not, it is a prelude or a prologue.
Very true. Very true.
So let's get that out of the way. So this is Matt Smith on a swing, accompanied by a small, dark-haired girl with a slightly northern accent, who they talk about, and the Doctor says he's looking for his friend, and she says suggestions about where to find her or what to do when he's when you're a bit saddened. So she's a young girl. Her mother calls her over and chats with her, and it turns out that the little girl is exactly who the doctor was looking for. So it's another young version of a companion.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, another.
How many is that we've had now? We've had.
I mean, this is what.
We didn't have a young. No, we did have a young Rose, didn't we? Did we have a young Rose?
We did technically in Father's Day.
We had a baby Rose. We've had.
Young Rose.
Yeah.
In Father's Day, we saw the young Rose as well.
Yeah, yeah. We've had a Rory.
Yeah.
And an Amy. And a River Song.
I mean, this is why I tend to think it's not a bad move for Moffat to move on, because you do. I think it's just natural, unless you're an extremely...
And Madame Pompadour.
Yes, yes. Seeing the companions as young, which is an understandable good way to sort of get in, trying to get underneath the character's skin a bit. But, you know, idea recycling does start to naturally occur.
Yeah.
And I have noticed that Moffat does clever things, but they're sort of clever things around very similar thematic devices, mm-hmm. especially on the timey-wimey scale. So, yeah, in a sense, it feels like, yes, we have been here before. My only little quibble with it, apart from it being a little predictable, I mean, you know exactly where it's going from the get-go. I think you'd have to be very young or quite naive or not know much about what's been going on late to really not work out where it's going. Sure. There's a couple of bits in the dialogue I felt were just a little bit artifice, a bit television. When she turns and sort of says, you know, you're very lonely. I mean, I hate the trope of the insightful child. I really loathe it.
Mm-hmm.
I know mothers and fathers like yourself tend to believe in it because, you know, you love your children and everything. And, you know, they'll say something and you think, oh, my God, you know, that's something that's so intuitive. That's so smart. But by and large, it is a bit of a trite trope to have constantly in television. The small kid is young, got a lot to learn, but there's an intuition there that surprises the main character. And it's just like, I didn't like that. Didn't like that at all. But the rest of it I thought was quite sweet. I quite liked on the swing. I thought the way she talked to him about the swing, up until she says, are you lonely, felt very much like a child might sort of talk to someone in that situation. Then you're a very lonely man. And if he'd said, well, because you're sitting on a swing by yourself, that would have worked. It wouldn't have been quite as colourful.
No, yeah.
But I could understand a kid making that jump. But it's you just seem very lonely. It just seems a bit, I don't know.
I get where you're coming from.
Okay. But aside from that, I thought it was quite nice. It was a nice, quite lull, simple scene. And it felt confident.
Yeah, it was nice. It was pleasant. Matt Smith was good as always. He's wearing his tweed as well, which is
I noticed that as well.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they recorded it somewhere. Maybe they recorded it in London. And it was the only 11th Doctor outfit they had to hand or something.
I was watching. I missed a bit of Red Nose Day with him
right.
Because the BBC seemed to cut down every YouTube thing, even the one that Costebra's put up. He wouldn't let me watch.
Mm.
But I was watching the year before. I think it was the year before. It might have been the year before that actually, where he comes on and he has to ad-lib his way through a little bit saying what's exciting about children in need, and bless him, it's cringeworthy watching him trying to be the doctor, and he's got all the cadence and the talk and the body language right, he just hasn't got the dialogue, and you can see him fumbling trying to sound like the doctor, and I thought bless him. And I mean, that must have been fairly early on in his tenure, again using that wonderful word. I'd like to see him do the same thing now. I bet he'd be better at it. So yeah, anyway.
Okay. Now, dear listener, you will have noticed that there's just the two of us today, this week. Do you know, I've just done that little thing where you sat next to someone and you say there's two of you, and you do that little pointy finger thing back and forth between the two of you, as if you were sat on my shoulder.
Oh, how cute. How sweet.
I think because you're speaking into my shoulder, James.
I suppose I am.
Into my ear, not my shoulder.
Speaking into your ear, yes. I think there's a far more of a sexual connotation than there is a parrot, but carry on. You know, a parrot speaks on your shoulder. You never think of it whispering in your ear, but you know, a sultry lover, you might. So I think there's more of a sexual connotation than there is a parrot one. But please continue.
Yeah.
You were saying there's just the two of us.
just
referring to the other guy not being here.
The other guy, yeah, Brian Terranova. Now we've got the Bells of St. John is on Saturday night. And so we're going to be doing the usual thing. If you're new to the podcast, and I know a lot of you are, hello, by the way, to our new listeners. What we'll be doing is once the show's gone out, we'll leave it a day or so, and then we'll have a big rant about it the following Monday, and then put the new podcast up later that day or by midweek. What will be interesting, though, if you consider, and you know, we've done something like 110 podcasts together, you and I.
Bloody hell!
Yeah. Oh, well, you've been on the podcast for about 110 of them.
Good Lord.
And then, dear listener, there's another 8 or 9 with just me and Brian, which are
crikey,
quite different. Now, if you were to go back in time, perhaps to September, August, September, October time, or further back to the previous year, you would hear James extolling the virtues of Amy Pond. Everything. Really? He loves Amy Pond.
Oh my God.
And
you've gone back and changed time, haven't you?
Timey-wimey, yeah, wibbly-wobbly.
That's how you know about my health.
Yeah, that's it.
Is my health going to get bad through the sort of exasperation at the fact that you've changed history?
That might.
I'm going to get very upset in a minute.
Don't go out in the snow over the next few days.
Crikey, that sounds a bit ominous.
Yes, indeed. So these new reviews, our new podcast review discussions for Series 7B will be quite different, because James will not be contending with the his perception, which is generally perhaps right, certainly in Amy's first series, that she wasn't perhaps written particularly well. Although, as Karen Gillan later displayed, she can act perfectly well when the script
absolutely
bites her into shape.
Absolutely.
Amy's Choice, beg your pardon, The Girl Who Waited, for instance. So, do you have, because we come, Series 7B starts next week. We're recording this on Saturday this week, so we've got 7 days. In 7 days' time, it will be on, so I'll be sat there watching it as we record this. Do you have anything that you're particularly looking forward to in Series 7B?
I am looking forward to the Ice Warriors.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, I hasten to say, not out of some sort of, and I can use this term without sounding rude, because it was a Craig Hinton one, and is so therefore so relevant to the Ice Warriors, since he wrote The God Engine. Not for the fan wankery reason that it's the Ice Warriors, but I just think the concept of the claustrophobic concept of the Cold War episode sounds very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm just trying to think what
I like the fact that it's set in the 80s as well.
I think
that's excellent. How many Doctor Who stories have been set in the 80s, other than contemporary ones? I'm thinking, well, since 2005, Father's Day. I can't think of any others.
No, nor can I. And I think I'm very much looking forward to, well, again, possibly for fan wankery reason, I'm curious about A Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS thingy one.
Right.
Just because, again, not because it's the TARDIS, but just because I think there could be a lot of, that could really be a hit or miss episode, depending on. Actually interested in Gaiman's, depending on how it's done, depending whether it's done like Invasions of Time or done good. So
I like Invasion of Time.
Obviously you enjoy time going at a slower pace than the rest of us.
Yeah, we don't actually know whether it is called Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS, but it does have Steve Thompson, who's written a couple of the Sherlocks, is the writer there, and the director is Matt King. I think it's his first Doctor Who episode.
So we'll be fan man king over that one.
Perhaps we will, perhaps we won't, who knows?
I don't know.
I would like to say he also wrote Curse of the Black Spot, Steve Thompson, but that was that kind of went a bit wibbly towards the end, didn't it? Not in a timey-wimey way, it just kind of fell to pieces.
Yeah, went a bit wobbly.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward as well to Gaiman's episode. Not again, because it's Neil Gaiman, who is a good writer. And The Doctor's Wife, I enjoyed. I thought there's some nice ideas, but if I was to be totally honest, I do feel it was better suited to a fan magazine in a lot of ways. The way it's written, it felt very much like a fan story rather than actually a professional one. As cruel as that is, a very good fan story, and with some lovely imagery and some lovely dialogue. I'd be interested to see what he does with the Cybermen. I think the Cybermen, as we said last for Series 7, Series 6B, that the Cybermen were horrendously treated, pretty much, with the episode.
It's interesting, isn't it, how Moffat has introduced these new ideas for the Cybermen, but not actually done anything really with them. It's like the snappy heads and the sort of go-go gadget tendrils that come out for them to move about on.
I totally agree. And I'm hoping that we'll see a rejuvenation in a sense. Because if I was a kid, I'd be starting to think the Cybermen are a bit crap, and I could probably beat one up if I met it. They're losing that power that I think, I never liked the Cybermen and the fact they were so mechanical. I did think, as I think I've said many times before on the 100-odd episodes, they were actually quite chilling in the way that they would so brutally transform people into such a horrid, emotionless thing. So that was quite scary, and I think they've lost that over since the Next Doctor, to be fair, Russell T. Davis, actually.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue that. I like the couple of things I'm encouraged by in particular. I know we've got our comedy Sontaran, so he can be the exception to the rule. As much as I like him, it is a kind of... it's not a Sontaran, is it? It's not what we expect from Sontaran. So we'll leave Potato Head aside for now. The Cybermen and the Ice Warriors, I'm really impressed by the designs of them. I also get the feeling, and I know it's 2013, it's 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, and there's a few other things that we may be seeing to hark back to the old days of Doctor Who in a kind of John Nathan Turner 20th anniversary series kind of way. But I get this feeling that, and the coming weeks will prove me right or wrong on this, but I do get this feeling, this sensation, this inkling that maybe Stephen Moffat's about to have produced the series that we've been waiting for since 2010, or maybe even, dare I say it, the series we've been waiting for since 2005, this kind of updated blend of modern televisual practices with classic Doctor Who.
I can see that argument there. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you think back to 2005, where it was such a simpler time for Doctor Who. You'd have Russell T. Davis saying, "I'm afraid most of it's going to be set around Earth, and you might have occasional spots on the space stations, but we can't afford planets and everything." And how the show has evolved through his era and then into Moffat's, where it is a far more intermix of places that, tend to end up having the Cardiff Millennium Place reception in them. But by and large, you have a lot of variety of different locations. And the show has grown and changed. And as you say, has in some respects come closer to feeling more comfortable with its roots. That was something I always felt with Stephen Moffat, is when he came on board, he seemed, for whatever reason, so eager to take it away from the 2005 to 2009 era, that it sort of took it away from the whole of Doctor Who to some degrees, that everything was being revitalized and changed. And the only things reoccurring are really either the major monsters like the Daleks, which were being revitalized and changed, or his monsters. And he seems to have got away from that. He seems to be more comfortable with Doctor Who and being a little more open to its whole history. And that's a good thing. I think the only sad thing is I've never felt really. One of my friends, as I said this before, has children, and she's always said that it's for her kids. Doctor Who started in 2005, and for them to be in the Moffat's era, suddenly it was like 2005 didn't exist. And now I know we've said that was very much how Doctor Who used to be.
Yeah.
I can understand for children growing up in this sort of day of television, it must be quite weird to sort of see that classic series gets quite heavily referenced. But aside from Anud and the TARDIS console in The Doctor's Wife, both in the same episode, he has kept well away from that era. I mean, The Doctor's Daughter, so many people thought that he was going to deal with something with that, since he was the one who actually encouraged her to survive. The episode.
So
we're told by Russell T. Davis.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'd imagine, because it wasn't said as a criticism, it was said as a good thing. I personally think it was a bad thing to do, but kind of hoped that if Moffat's coming to the end of his tenure, that he would perhaps feel a little more comfortable with that era as well. Maybe I'm doing him an injustice, but I mean, there's so much that happened in that era which impacted on the Doctor. Even the Time War gets like one reference really, and a couple of references Not yet, and maybe there was one RTD reference on one of the cut-deleted scenes in Series 5. But, you know, Time War, big thing. You might not like it, but it has, in some ways, dictated the character's evolution. And, yeah, Regenerations allows you to get away from that a bit. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's something I would be... I would respect him a lot if he did actually... maybe throw, and maybe he will for the 50th, maybe he'll have no choice, I don't know. But yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting season. I think the fact that he's not repeating previous season, he's trying a different tact with the companion this time, I think that's interesting. I think it's got I've got high hopes for it, to be honest.
Yeah, I do as well, and I don't think we're alone in that. I think a lot of people are looking forward to some really good Doctor Who over the coming weeks.
But that is based on the fact that he did, while he did a lot of mistakes, I think, in a couple last series, he did do, I don't know, it felt like they were mistakes that they would learn from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm hoping that we'll see that, yeah, in this season.
Yes, okay. If indeed, well, you know, let's not get into the old confusing subject of whether it's a season or half a season. It's a run of episodes in early 2013, yeah. Yes. So
I'm hoping it'll have learned from even its previous part of the season as well, because there was still a few things in there that I thought were a bit weak.
Mm, yeah. It's well, I think the other problem with the first half of this series, because, you know, everyone's going to watch it on one DVD box set, aren't they? Once, mm-hmm. once the complete DVD box set is available. But it has this kind of, it was only five episodes, wasn't it? So you got five episodes, and then it stops all of a sudden. And usually after at episode five, you're just getting into the series. You know, like back in 2005, Dalek was episode six.
Yeah.
You know, things are just getting going. So it's a bit tricky, I think, if you're certainly for long-running Doctor Who fans, maybe even for little Doctor Who fans, just get five episodes, and oh, no more till Christmas, and then no more till April. Easter. Yeah.
I mean, that's a hell of a long time, especially for a kid.
You can grow a hair on your chest in that time, I think. So, on that profound note, I think we'll bring this week's Castoria's podcast to a close. No, we won't. On that profound note, I want to just move on to the recommendations, which we skipped last week. James, what have you been watching lately?
I've not watched any Doctor Who in the last 2 weeks.
Right.
The only thing I've been doing is I listened to more of the Masters of Luxor, slowly going through it.
Right. And
I'm on about episode 4 of 6.
Right.
Really enjoying it. Yeah. I think it's a beautiful adaptation. I can't really fault it. I kind of wish I'd bought the scripts, the scripts that came out years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Just for the if there's any sort of uninitiated listeners, could you just furnish us on the Masters of Luxor?
Yeah, Masters of Luxor was technically planned. I think it was meant to be the second episode, second serial, which ended up being the Daleks, and it didn't come to pass for various reasons. The episode was then sort of produced out on a script format that you could actually buy and read, and then Nigel Robinson, I believe. Who is a very adept author, came and tweaked the script a bit for Big Finish, and Big Finish have released it as part of their Lost Episodes Chronicles.
Right. Yep.
And they fitted it a little later in the continuity than it was actually planned. So I think there's been a little bit of rejigging. But not too much. I mean, as I say, I've not read the original scripts that they released. I presumed I've seen it. I mean, this is the original scripts. It's not what Big Finish did, is it? This is before Big Finish took their hand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to see how different it is, because in the first episode, Ian and the Doctor's relationship feels a lot more, not necessarily abrasive. Yeah, but it's a little more. They're at each other a little more than they tend to be by the period that it seems to refer to a little later on, where they're all a little lot more of a family. Not horrendously, but it feels a little more like where they were at the Daleks. And I wonder if Nigel's actually not over-tweaked the script. So in some ways, they feel a little more, as you say, a little more fractured than not as fractured as the Daleks, not at all. But Ian's calling the Doctor out on situations, mocking him for not being able to control his time shift, things like that, which are done in ways where it's suggested that Ian does it out of a bit of frustration, not out of like a friendly banter. So it does feel a bit odd in that sense, but you can't really see a flaw in the voice acting. As I say, it flows like a Doctor Who episode. It feels like you are enjoying something which could have been done at that time.
Right.
And there's a lovely insert where they've actually montaged the team together using elements, and they've made sure that the set that they're in looks like an old 60s set, rather than, you know, the great sort of wonders that you can do with CG montage these days. It feels very 60s. So yes, it's a brilliant tale, and if you've not been supporting Big Finish because you think Big Finish can be a little too out there, then I would really suggest that you try The Master's Luxor, because it just shows you how much of a companion to the show that that company has been or can be.
Yeah, okay.
What's that you?
I've been watching. I was watching The Tales of Wang Chung a few nights ago, but I didn't get to the end of it.
Oh dear.
I still have that, basically because it's 6 episodes long, and I put it on at 11:30. So I didn't reach the end yet. I still have the final 2 episodes to watch, which I will be looking forward to watching over the next week or so. And one of the reasons I hadn't finished it is because I've been reading. Full Circle by Andrew Smith, and watching Full Circle as well. This is in anticipation of my trip to the WriterCon, in which I'll be speaking to Andrew Smith himself tomorrow, chronologically, for me, but a few days ago for you, dear listener. So, it's, you know, I don't want to kind of, just in case we use some material from WriterCon, I don't want to preempt myself. But it is a surprisingly, I'm not talking the book, I'm talking the episode itself, the serial itself. I think it's severely underrated. I think it's one of the most mature pieces of science fiction in Doctor Who.
Mm.
In terms of the concept, the backstory, there's a believable planet. It's a believable planet with a believable ecosystem and a believable society living on it. But it does suffer from the Iridius syndrome, doesn't it? Because it is a planet that is supposed to be an entire planet that suffers from this mistfall. You only see a tiny part of it, and there's no indication that, you know, the other side of the planet, there could be a big desert and some, you know, some sand creatures suffering from snowfall. You know, but it gets around that. It diverts you from that by this strange this evolutionary cycle that these creatures go through. And then you've got the big joke at the end, or towards the end. I think it's a fantastic piece of work. I really do.
It's I've never read it, but I mean, I've always loved that whole season. It seems such a stark and bold move to take it in such a, as you say, such a deeper, complex. It's not storylines necessarily, but ideas. And the show, especially after Graham Williams' era, I mean, it must have hit like a brick in the face.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I spoke to Andrew Smith. I've emailed Andrew Smith just to give him an idea of what we're going to talk about. Well, I spoke to him over Skype back in 2010 when he was first coming back into the Doctor Who fold with Big Finish. We did the interview, and some of it's on Casterbus. It was a very long chat that we had, and one of the things he told me was that he was among a lot of people who weren't that impressed with Doctor Who at this particular time, because the Graham Williams era had been a bit silly in that. So for him to have, and I may cut this bit out, I'm just talking to you now.
Sure.
For him to have this, what is essentially a Douglas Adams joke across 4 episodes, this whole bureaucracy and the replacement of all the parts and the constant ongoing maintenance of the sand, of the Starliner, only for the Doctor to discover that the reason that they're doing this is because they don't know how to fly it. It's, you know, it's maybe the delivery is different, but it is as silly as anything that had gone in the previous 18 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I find very interesting. So anyway,
I suppose it's more about tone, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because I know it's a few series back, but you take say, the Pirate Planet, the actual idea is actually fantastic and quite horrific. But aside from that one moment at the end that Tom Baker plays out, it's trivialized by the comedy and the humor and the light, frothy Doctor Who template.
Yes.
So no,
So what do you think of Full Circle?
It's been a while since I watched it. Not a massive while, but...
Watching it the other day, as I've said.
Yeah.
And I noticed from the outfits, they're very of their time. Although there isn't an awful lot of makeup in it, and you'll see where I'm going with this, there is this kind of... When I get there. There is this kind of resemblance to a kind of a new romantics nightclub, the Starliner. Because you have this lobby area with the door where you're going, where they have it sealed at this entrance, and you've got these two tunnels going off, and you've got someone in the middle signing people in. Mm. And then it goes off, and then there's lots of corridors around, and it opens out into this big area, which is like the bridge where the Deciders stand in their like triumvirate, and people come in and gather at the bottom where they could quite easily be dancing, and the Deciders could be Duran Duran or Heaven 17 or Spandau Ballet. With their strange triangular outfits on. The only thing that is missing is the makeup.
The two things I got from Full Circle that I remember is, one, as a kid, it's one of the first Doctor Who's I actually properly remember.
Yes, but same here.
Aside from Full Circle, where I have vague memories of the Famazi, whatever they were. But Full Circle was obviously the spiders hatching.
Yeah.
Yes, it was the Leisure High. Full Circle was the first one I remember. I don't remember Megloss, apart from a picture of Megloss.
In Starburst? It
was terrifying me. That was in Starburst, yeah, I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, same here, yeah.
But Full Circle is the one I remember. I remember the cliffhanger with the spiders.
Mm-hmm.
Which, at the time as a kid, was quite terrifying.
Yeah.
And I also remember K-9 being decapitated. And I also had, do you remember those viewfinders?
Yeah.
With the red ones?
And
it clicked. I had the Full Circle one of those. So
really?
I had the first episode on
there. Was Doctor Who on viewfinder?
Yeah, there was a Doctor Who on viewfinder.
God, I never had any. I just had Spider-Man.
I had that. I also had one that was actually more of a rolling one that you actually turned, and it was more of an animal. That was quite cool. But the viewfinder one, yeah, I had Full Circle. Yeah. So I remember it from that, and this very grumpy looking... Tom Baker standing outside the TARDIS is one image which stands out. But yes, no, I thought it was a good season. I don't think it was one of the best ones of the season, just because it was such a big idea that it didn't quite really work with the scope of the budget. But I really respect that era for taking such a different tone with the show. And trying to, because I mean, it was a show that couldn't do what everyone would want it to do, which was obviously Star Wars.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the other thing as well... carry on.
That's really what I was going to say.
Well, what I was going to say is, it goes back to what we were saying about Tom Baker having three producers.
Yeah.
Four in some ways. We won't count Barry Letts, really. But, you know, he has these three producers, he has these three eras, and it adds a new sort of tone, a new layer, a new... added texture and context to the Fourth Doctor, which is why he managed to be successful for 7 years. And I think David Tennant maybe recognised that. I don't think Matt Smith has. Which is a shame, I think. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Castorbus podcast with the Kate. We will be back next week. I'm hoping Brian will be with us. And we'll be discussing the Bells of St. John. Until then, it's goodbye from me and James.